You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And Republicans want us to thank millionaire Zane Tankel. Tankel? Tinkle? It's Tankel. Okay. Yeah. The CEO of Applebee's New York franchise and owner of 40 Applebee's restaurant. Republicans want us to think this guy is a job creator. But after Tankel went on the Fox Business Network last week, we discovered what he really is. Scrooge! Seriously. Can't be bothered to give his employees health insurance. No, I'm not making this up. In fact, here is a quote from Zane Tankel, for example, in this interview.
The model's been set. I don't want to, I'm sure all our people are watching this right now, so I don't want to make any commitments one way or another. I want to simply say we're looking at it, we're evaluating it. If it's possible to do without cutting people back, I'm delighted to do it. But that also rolls back expansion. It rolls back hiring more people. And in a best case scenario, we only shrink the labor force minimally.
Oh, Obamacare is just going to take him apart. It's just going to destroy. For this guy to have to actually provide health insurance to his employees. Keep going. He really is a Scrooge who can't be bothered. I mean, this, you know, since voters last Tuesday rejected House Republicans' attempts to repeal Obamacare, it is now, to quote Speaker of the House John Boehner, law of the land, Obamacare. That means beginning in 2014, corporations across America that employ more than 50 people will have a new civic responsibility under the law to provide health insurance to their workers. This is the employer mandate at work. Health insurance is not a luxury in this country. Obamacare is not forcing employers to give their workers a new big screen TV or monthly spa treatments. The law simply recognizes that 45,000 Americans die every year because they don't have health insurance. And that large employers, those who employ 50 or more people, are best equipped to be a source of life-saving medical care for millions of working Americans. It's an idea that was first proposed by that socialist president who wanted to take over America's health care system back in 1971, Richard Nixon. In fact, providing health insurance to employees is a good business decision. Not only attracts more qualified workers, it also leads to higher job retention rates, higher employer satisfaction. But don't tell Zane Tinkle that. He's outraged. Since he employs more than 50 people, he's now going to be required to provide health insurance to his workers, which many of his competitors and small businesses already do. If Tinkle wants to keep screwing his employees, then he'll have to pay a $2,000 freeloader fine for every worker who will now have to rely on government programs like Medicaid to get the care they need. And that was that clip that you just heard from when he was on Fox Business Report, where he says, well, we'll see. We've done the math, and they're going to try to only shrink minimally. Right. Poor Zane Tankel. He says if he's forced to give his employees health insurance, then he's first going to have to fire some of them. You know, 100 years ago, he'd likely have said the same thing about bathroom breaks for his employees, or having 12-year-olds run his fryers, or letting food inspectors into his restaurants. The vast majority of Americans have clearly concluded that if a business owner can't run his business in the best interest of the community and its workers, which includes providing health insurance, then he or she doesn't deserve to run a business. Get out of the way. Let somebody come into that space who can. You know, there used to be a business ethic in America that put the community ahead of profit. It went back to when Henry Ford wanted to pay his workers enough so that they could buy the Model Ts that they were producing. It's a business ethic that was enforced by law back when state governments could, and often did, this throughout the 19th century, and the 18th century for that matter, revoke the corporate charters of businesses that were operating against the best interests of the community. But that business ethic has been replaced by Wall Street's good-as-greed ethic. You know, Reaganomics, which finds its roots in Victorian England and stories like A Christmas Carol, where working people are condemned to Bob Cratchit poverty, forced to toil long hours under modern-day Ebenezer Scrooges with crappy pay and no benefits. Charles Dickens, whose father once went to debtor's prison, would have blown his lunch at the idea of Ebenezer Scrooge being honored with a title like Job Creator. And now Fox is treating Zane Tinkle as if he and not his customers are the job creators? Tinkle claims the math just doesn't add up to be able to provide health insurance to some of his employees without firing some of them first. He says there's three ways to make a comeback. He says about the money needed to pay for health insurance. Here it is.
There's three ways it has to come back. It's real simple. More efficiencies, reduce overhead, or raise prices. Let's look at each. In this environment, you can't raise prices, particularly in our space. It's not possible. Efficiencies, hopefully we've got all our efficiencies. We've just faced three terrible years in the environment and the economy. We've been enforcing and putting more and more in every year. So then it's cut back on overhead.
As in, let's fire people or pay them even less. What Tinkle doesn't want to admit is that he actually has more than three ways to pay for health insurance. He can also cut his own salary. He can also reduce the dividends he pays to his stockholders. The math is there, but Tinkle would have to reconsider his own greed. And since Scrooge wouldn't do those things, neither will Tinkle. Tinkle is also stupidly acting as if he's the only one who will be affected by Obamacare. All big businesses will have to cover their employees' health insurance now. So whatever business hit Applebee's takes will also be felt by his competitors. He's at no disadvantage whatsoever. But on outlets like Fox Business, the victims of this insane right-wing thinking aren't the 45,000 Americans who die every year because they don't have health insurance. Instead, the victims are multimillionaires like Zane Tinkle, who will have to sacrifice some of their bottom line to keep their employees healthy. One of the Fox News business talking heads asks Tinkle, well, check this out.
Is this the most challenging time you've ever seen?
It is. It is.
And because of the regulations?
All the regulations.
Yeah, right. Oh, this is so sad. Unlike what you hear in the conservative media outlets, President Obama has not deployed his brown shirts to confiscate private property and redistribute Zane Tinkle's wealth. He hasn't choked out the private sector with big government regulations. In fact, corporate profits under President Obama are astronomically high. The average annual real corporate profit growth rate since President Obama took office is 77.9%, which makes Obama the best president for corporate profits since 1900. In second place is Republican Warren Harding, who in 1920 ran on a campaign platform of less government and business, more business and government, and he only saw corporate profits go up 17.7% during his term. President Obama has been corporate America's best friend. And after swimming in astronomically high profits, corporations are now being asked to reinvest some of that wealth back into their employees by providing them with health insurance. It's the very least they can do. And seriously, do you really want to eat at a restaurant filled with sick employees? So-called job creators like Zane Tinkle have to understand that the letters CEO in front of their names do not give them the right to abuse workers or exploit them as political pawns. What it means is that we the people gave them permission to run a business, and we can withdraw that permission anytime we want if we choose. Zane, take a course in history, in American history, and pay special attention to that part about the rights of workers. We ended slavery and indentured servitude in this country. We decided that working people are entitled to be treated decently in the workplace, even that if that means that Papa John's founder, John Schnatter, can't build another guest house for his castle. Yes, the founder of Papa John's lives in a castle with a moat, a real castle and a real moat. Poor guy. And now he might have to pay for health insurance or pay $2,000 a year to cover the cost per employee, to cover the cost of our paying for it with Medicaid.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
When is corporate America going to wake up? It's not just about the profit. This is America. Yes, life in the fast lane. You hop in that HOV fast lane all by yourself in California. It's not one of those states, I don't believe, where they're saying now if you pay a little extra, you get to ride the fast lane too. Instead, you have to have an extra actual person with you. A person. Jonathan Freeman attorney, nonprofit consultant, co-founder of the Center for Corporate Policy. CorporatePolicy.org is the website. Twitter is Yogi Stein, Yogi Stein, is on the line with us. Hey, Jonathan, how are you?
Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine.
Oh, wonderful. Great.
And,
how are you doing, Tom?
And I see you, too. I am doing great, but I'll get better, Jonathan. I hope the same is true for you.
Yes.
So you hopped into the HOV lane, the two persons or more lane, on a freeway in or near San Francisco, where in the neighborhood, more or less, where you live. And what happened?
Well, it was during the morning rush hour, and as you said, the carpool lane is restricted during rush hour to vehicles carrying two or more persons. And road signs clearly say that, and the vehicle code says that the definition of a person includes a natural person or a corporation. And I've been packing incorporation papers from my family foundation for years in the car trying to get this particular traffic ticket, and finally I did.
So you had a corporation in the car with you. I mean, literally, you had the incorporation papers. Police officer pulled you over.
Yeah.
Finally.
And so when I got stopped, I told the cops that I said, look, I've got incorporation papers for a corporation, which is a person under the vehicle code 470. I quoted it for him.
Right.
And he, of course, didn't get it. So and thankfully, he still gave me a ticket because now he can push the point
right in
court.
So you're gonna fight this in court. You're going to say there were two persons in the car. Didn't the police officer actually say you have to have two persons? He used that word?
Right. He said, I said, if I had a corporation, he said, you need to have two persons in the car. I said, thank you.
So you're not just going to take this to traffic court?
Well, what's going to happen when he gets when the judge comes up with this case? He's going to be thinking, well, if I say yes, it's okay, then everybody can use incorporation papers to drive on the carpool lane
right
during the restricted times.
Right. And if I say it's not okay, then he just went up against Scalia.
That's right. he's saying, well, corporations aren't persons for the purpose of driving in the carpool lane, which is a form of discrimination, which I don't think he wants to get into.
Well, so, corporations are not persons with regard to marriage. That, is that not a precedent? I mean, I remember there was a group up in Portland when I lived there. In fact, I spoke at one of their gigs and we had them on the radio, that incorporated and tried to run this corporation as a candidate in an election, saying it was a person, and the judge ruled against them.
Right, and you can't vote because you're not a citizen, but here we're actually going to invoke the wisdom of Antonin Scalia and say and ask for them to interpret the law strictly, which is it says that the definition of a person under the vehicle code includes natural persons and corporations. And
so this is in the motor vehicle code. It says that a person includes a corporation.
Yes. A California vehicle code section 470. This is actually pretty standard. If you go to the San Rafael city code and under the definitions of persons, it says a person is a natural person, or a corporation.
Right. Are you prepared to appeal this all the way to the Supreme Court, Jonathan?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
That is incredible. If it gets to the Supreme Court in time for the retirement of one of the right wingers and the replacement by somebody rational, hopefully, by President Obama, that would make for a very interesting case. Even if not, it would make for an interesting case.
Right. And I just don't know, though, if it's ever going to get that far. But still, the point is to push it in court and make it a really good learning tool for people to understand how readily corporations are accepted as quote-unquote persons.
Right.
They should be.
Yeah, and turn this into a cause celeb. I mean, let's get as much publicity as possible for the fact that Jonathan Freeman has gotten busted driving with two persons in his car in the two-person lane because one of those persons was a corporation. Your defense, I suppose you could play that clip of Mitt Romney saying, corporations are people, my friend.
Say that again? If what?
Mitt Romney famously during the campaign.
Oh, yes, he did.
Said, you know, corporations are people, my friend. Don't you?
Corporations are people, my friend.
There it is, as a matter of fact.
Right.
Mitt has a way of hopping into the show from time to time.
Yeah, that's quite fallacious.
Yeah, quite fallacious. So, Jonathan, do you know of anybody else around the country who's doing this, and is corporatepolicy.org on this as well?
I don't think anybody else is doing this because there aren't very many places that have carpool lanes, as I recall. They're up in Seattle. They're just north of San Francisco here in L.A., but I don't know of any other places in the country that actually have carpool lanes that do this. Probably in the Beltway, but I don't know. And of course, the Center for Corporate Policy is giving me support. It's just got an email from Charlie Cray today, and another one from Daniel Greenwood, who is a constitutional lawyer up at Hofstra, and just wonderful intellect. So I'm getting a lot of support on it.
Yeah. No doubt about it, and worthwhile, and of course here you are now. We're talking with Jonathan Freeman. Jonathan is an attorney, a nonprofit consultant, the co-founder of the Center for Corporate Policy. Hopped in his car with a corporation, with the incorporation papers for his family foundation, and got busted for driving without a second person in the car. And the police officer apparently has never heard of Antonin Scalia. Very interesting, Jonathan.
Yes.
I wish you the very best on this.
Thank you.
Keep it up, my friend.
Talking to you, Tom.
And let us know if anything happens. We'll get you back on the air, okay?
You bet.
Okay, do good, brother. Jonathan Freeman, you can check that out at corporatepolicy.org. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We will be giving away a copy today of my book on the history of democracy, Cracking the Code, and asking the question, should the Applebee's franchise be out of business? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. When are we going to go back to the late 19th century, early 20th century, when if a corporation did not operate in the interest of the public first and make profit for its owners second, now, you know, it's presumed it has to do the second in order to continue in business, but if it didn't do both, then we simply said, see you later. We're going to pull your articles of incorporation. Now they're saying, oh, we're persons, and oh, you know, all this other hysterical stuff. Anyhow, Tad in St. Albans, West Virginia. Hey, Tad, what's on your mind today?
Well, good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, I'm just trying to catch my breath. Sorry. Okay. I just have to remind, can I ask you a question? If I remember quickly, what if you said the only thing by law that a corporation has to do by law?
Well, and arguably they don't even have to do that by law, which, and it's not the corporation, it's the officer's responsibility, the CEO, and that is to increase shareholder value, the value of the stock or the profits of the corporation. And well, but even that's a tenuous thread. That's based on a Michigan Supreme Court case, Dodge v. Ford, that, you know, from the 1930s, it's never been tested in federal court to the best of my knowledge.
Okay, but
because there's a lot of corporations that lose money and nobody goes to jail over it.
Mm-hmm. But also, I have to remind that we've had to force corporations to stop children from working.
Yep.
We've had to use the government to stop corporations to put safety measures so it doesn't kill workers.
Yep. And there's still 50,000 people a year who die in the workplace in the United States. Yes.
And that just means we need a stronger government. I'm guessing the gist I'm getting to is that in order for corporations to change, we got to force them to change.
I totally agree, and in fact, history agrees with you, Tad. Well said. Thank you very much, Pat in Aspen, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
I was just listening about your corporate thing. You're talking about corporate tax may be up this year because of the profits. And, of course, we're on the old tax structure, so there should be more corporate tax to tax, right?
You're saying because corporate profits are up, there's more revenue going into the coffers in Washington, D.C. Yes and no. The most profitable business in America right now, or the most profitable investment in America right now, is investing in a lobbyist. Those companies that have successfully invested in lobbyists have seen returns as high as 17,000%. For every dollar they put in, they get $17,000 back, typically in tax breaks. There's all these holes that have been drilled in the tax code, specifically for individual companies and or industries, as the case may be. So,
See, the thing I'm trying to get at is Obama going to be going after those and trying to close those?
Let's hope so.
Because, see, if he gets rid of all these other tax breaks, they're supposedly going off in January. Is he going to try to close these loopholes and all these other things?
Here's the problem,
Pat. More?
Here's the problem. The Constitution does not provide for the White House to originate legislation. And anything that has to do with taxation, not only is legislation, but according to the Constitution, has to originate in the House of Representatives. So if you want to see individual tax loopholes done away with, there is only one place that can start, and that's in the U.S. House of Representatives, which right now is controlled by Republicans. So there's a lot of speculation that, yes, they want to close tax loopholes. They want to do away with the home mortgage interest deduction. This was, you know, one of Romney and Paul Ryan's things. In fact, this is Paul Ryan's budget. Want to do away with the child tax credit for people who have kids and you can deduct some of the cost of raising your children. Do away with education deductions. Do away with medical expense deductions. These are all loopholes in the tax code that are used by the middle class. But because it's the Republican Party that controls the House of Representatives, and by the way, Democrats got 500,000 more votes for their members of the House of Representatives in this last election last week than Republicans did. But because of Republican gerrymandering in a handful of states, you've got states like Pennsylvania and Ohio where the Republicans lost the state in total votes for the House of Representatives, lost the state in total votes for President Obama, and yet managed to hang on to the majority of the states in terms of representatives in Washington, D.C., because their districts have been so gerrymandered. But I'm not hopeful about this, Pat, because the Republicans are in charge. So we'll see where it goes. Joseph in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hey, Joseph, what's up? Thanks for listening to SiriusXM.
It's Jason, but that's cool. You can call me
Jason. My apologies.
I had high hopes for Obama his first 4 years. And I'm going to be honest with you, I voted for Romney this past time around because it's the math's not adding up. We're $16 trillion in debt.
Wait a minute. Romney's math added up for you?
Huh?
Romney's math added up for you?
Well, no, I'm talking about Obama right now, so let's hold off on the smoke and mirrors.
Okay.
But anyway, we're $16 trillion in debt.
Right.
A lot more people on welfare.
Hang on just a second. Of that $16 trillion in debt, how much of it was run up during Republican presidencies?
Hold on. We got a lot more.
No, I understand. You got a list you got to read, you know, to get your $20 from the RNC. But the, you know, of that $16 trillion in debt, how much of it was run up during Republican presidencies?
I think when Obama took over, I want to say it was around 9 or 10 trillion.
Okay, there you go. And who was the last president to submit a balanced budget to Congress?
Okay, so am I right on that? What was it, 9 or 10?
It was in that neighborhood. It was like 9 and change. Oh, it was 10. Okay. Shane thinks it was 10 and change, but it was in that neighborhood.
You know,
you're right.
You cut it any way you want to. He spent more, you know, in his 4 years than Bush did in 8.
No, actually what happened is the tax revenues are at a low, the tax revenues right now are the lowest they've been in 62 years. And the reason why is because we're in the Bush Great Depression.
And I do understand that you've got less people paying taxes on average than, I mean, if you,
because people are unemployed.
You know,
yeah.
Right. But the thing is,
okay, it was $10,600,000,000 when Obama came into office, by the way.
Say again?
$10,600,000,000 was the national debt.
Okay. But anyway, since Obama's been in, he has managed to, in 4 years, he can't get the unemployment rate below 8%.
Now it's 7.9% right now.
It would run around 4.5%. And you can look it up.
Yeah.
So basically, he's doubled the unemployment rate. More people on food stamps, more people on welfare. We're giving him 4 more years to raise up the deficit.
Right. So you're of the opinion, Joseph. Let me get this right, if I may. Joseph, stop trying to shout over me. Let me get this right. You're of the opinion that we have more people on food stamps and more people on unemployment right now, and that the way to solve that problem is to kick them off food stamps and off unemployment?
Are you letting me talk?
Yeah, I just asked you a question.
Let me ask you something. I'm a business owner.
No, I just asked you a question. You're not going to answer it?
No, because I'm making my point. I'll answer your question in a second.
Okay. Darlene in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. Hey, Darlene, what's up?
Hi. I just had a comment. Years ago when I used to work as a secretary, unless they've changed the laws, small business people could write those premiums, what they had to pay for people's insurance, off on their income tax.
Yes, and they have not changed that law. It is a deductible expense.
Okay, so then what's the guy's problem with paying, you know, if he can write it all off, what's the difference?
Right, well, assuming that he's profitable and he's paying income taxes, that's the fifth way. You know, he said that there's only three ways, which didn't include the fourth way, which is cut his salary or cut corporate profits. And you're right, the fifth way is, you know, reduce your income tax load by deducting the stuff from your income taxes. Excellent point, Darlene. Thank you very much for calling it. I appreciate it and for pointing it out. Bruce in Seneca, South Carolina. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing, buddy?
Good. What's up?
I'm just wondering. I'm an independent. I'm not a registered Republican or Democrat. I'm just wondering. Everybody says Obama done many great things, and I'm not saying everything that he done was bad, because it's not. We do need a national national health care policy of some sort. So I'm not bashing Obamacare. I'm just wondering why all these extreme Democrats want to bash Republicans. When Obama came in, he had a Republican Senate and he had a Democratic Senate and House.
Yeah, for 2 months and one day. And then Scott Brown got sworn in as the Republican senator from Massachusetts, and Obama lost the ability to block a filibuster in the United States Senate. So for 2 months and one day, less than 9 weeks, Obama had an absolute majority in the House and Senate. And then these guys who got together in this conspiracy at the caucus room restaurant on the night that Obama was sworn into office, Frank Luntz, Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, Bob Ensign, John Ensign, and Bob Corker, and Newt Gingrich. They got together and they swore that once that 2 months and one day was over, that anything Obama tried to do that might help the economy, they would block. And they did. And they did for three and a half years, three and three quarters of a year. These guys blocked everything. Nancy Pelosi sent them a bill that simply said, we're no longer going to let corporations deduct from their taxes. In other words, have you and me pay for the cost of shipping factories to China. The Republicans blocked that in the Senate. I mean, just rational stuff. So, yeah, Obama had 8 weeks and one day before Scott Brown was sworn in Massachusetts, where he had a filibuster-proof Senate. And in that, he was able to pass the largest middle-class tax cut in the history of the United States. He saved Chrysler and GM. He dropped us from 800,000 jobs a month being lost to hundreds of thousands every month being made. He increased spending on education.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
He got the banksters out of the student loan business, which saved us all $80 billion. He strengthened hate crime laws. He expanded children's health insurance programs. I could go on. So, what are the numbers in Arizona? Dr. Mike Newcomb, host of the Mike Newcomb Show on 1480 KPHX in Phoenix, Arizona. KPHX.com. Mike Newcomb, NEWCOMB.net, his website. And, of course, many of you hear Mike regularly when he fills in for me on this show on those rare occasions when I boogie out of town or take off. Mike, welcome back.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing today?
Just great. So, Dr. Mike, fill us in. We are hearing... out here in the rarefied bubble era of Washington, D.C., we are hearing that in Arizona, you guys are still counting ballots in Joe Arpaio's district?
Yeah, well, actually, they're counting ballots all over the state, Tom. It's a real travesty. There was about 1.8 million ballots cast total in this state, and of those, there was about 600,000 that, after the election was over, were not counted. So about one-third of the entire vote in this state.
Wow.
It's actually been, well, it's a little close now, but that's how many were undone.
How did that
right
happen?
Now, as of Saturday, they said there's still about 486,000 votes still uncounted. And of those, Tom, about 300,000 are early ballots, but even more concerning is almost 200,000 of those are provisional ballots, and those are mostly minority voters, too. So there's a cry now for an investigation. A lot of people are saying that the Department of Justice and the Civil Rights Division really need to get involved in this, because it really does seem as though this is a systemic sort of violation of civil rights. I mean 200,000 ballots, mostly minorities. I mean, that's outrageous.
Is Arizona one of those states that's covered by the 1965 Voter Rights Act
Yes, I believe we are, and I do believe that they had sent out election monitors to Arizona, particularly in Maricopa County, where Sheriff Joe Arpaio is, to monitor the elections, Tom. But even this, outside of all these ballots not being counted and the enormous number of provisional ballots, because here in Arizona, you have to either show photo identification or you have two non-photo forms of ID, whether it's a bank statement, you know, or a bank utility, statement, something along those lines. But if you don't meet those criteria, then a provisional ballot has to be cast. But the onus then, Tom, is that if those provisional ballots are cast, those voters have to show up to the election department by this Wednesday and show another form of ID in order for those provisionals even to be counted. So it's really putting a great burden on the minority voters. And I'll tell you, there's some races that are still outstanding here. I mean, I don't know if, you know, Rich Carmona was a very hotly contested race with Congressman Jeff Flake.
Right.
There's only about 70,000-80,000 votes separating them right now. But if you think about it, 200,000 votes, and if they're mostly all minorities, you saw how Hispanics broke here in the country, 75%. I mean, that race technically could very well be in play.
Has Carmona retracted his concession?
I think he did. I think from what we heard out here, he kind of said, we're going to now wait until all the votes are counted. And I think precisely because of that math, because it is a statewide race, U.S. Senate, and with 200,000 minority votes still not counted, and if three-fourths of those went to Rich Carmona, now you've got a nail-biter. So
you know,
there's a lot at stake here in Arizona.
So people who are listening to this program in Arizona who cast a provisional ballot, who were told, sorry, your ID isn't adequate, you have to fill out this ballot rather than a regular one, those people need to do what right now?
They need to get to they need to get online, look at the Arizona Secretary of State's office website, and find out where they need to go in person to basically make sure they have either that photo ID that's valid, or the two non-photo IDs, you know, bank statements, utility statements, and have an election official certify that. Otherwise, their vote will be invalidated. It will not count.
Incredible. This is exactly...
It's tragic, Tom, that this is happening here in Arizona.
Well, it's exactly what the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, and, you know, the guys who came up with these laws wanted. I mean, this is Paul Weyrich's, dream is... You know, as the voting populace goes down, our leverage goes up.
No, and on top of that, our Secretary of State, Ken Bennett, actually, who oversees all the elections, was an official on the Romney campaign and openly supported Romney, which I consider a grave conflict of interest when you have a Secretary of State endorsing a particular statewide candidate.
Yeah, although that was also the case in Ohio and Florida. There's a piece of federal legislation, although, again, I don't know if that would run afoul of the 10th Amendment, to simply say the people who are in charge of counting the votes and determining the parameters of voting cannot have an interest in either party. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, if all the refs in the NFL all of a sudden came out in favor of one football team.
Right. Could you imagine that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's...
Although sometimes it feels that way when you're an Eagle fan, but...
Okay.
So what's being done?
We'll
keep you posted on this, Tom, but you're right. You did astutely bring that up, that people who did cast provisional ballots, make sure that they, you know, go to that Arizona Secretary of State website to find out exactly where they need to go to bring that.
But I'm guessing the Republicans are sitting around going, there's no way 200,000 people are going to take another day off work and go show up and stand in line for another 3 or 4 hours to show their ID so that their vote gets counted.
No, and this is why many people in our community now are calling for an investigation with the Department of Justice and the Civil Rights Division to see if this is just, you know, systemic voter disenfranchisement, Tom, because that's outrageous. I mean, one third of the votes, you know, were either early ballot or provisional and weren't even counted. And
right.
That's just unacceptable.
And people probably showed up with their voter ID card, the one that they got in the mail from the Secretary of State, thinking, okay, I'm registered as a voter. Here's proof of it. And it wasn't enough.
And trust me, Tom, with the Senate Bill 1070 that we had, and I know we spoke about it on your program, where it would give law enforcement the ability to say if somebody was here legally or illegally based off of their gut, whether or not they looked like they were legal citizens, I can guarantee you that same sentiment is what has driven this provisional ballot disenfranchisement here. I mean, I'm sure it's people at home who's looking at people, thinking they're people of color, they're probably not citizens, and we're going to put the onus, the burden on
Real quick question, Dr. Mike. If one of these Republican poll watchers had simply challenged a voter, does that force them into provisional ballot?
Yeah, technically, yes. If they just challenged them and felt they didn't have the right ID, then you're lucky if you even got a provisional ballot. Some of them might not even got provisional ballot. They might have been told to go home.
Amazing. Dr. Mike Newcomb for KPAHX in Phoenix. Dr. Mike, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across America, Europe, and all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations all across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems nationwide. More people watch or listen to the Tom Hartman Program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. Newt Gingrich and his wife, Calista Gingrich, both have new books up. His new book is called Victory at Yorktown, a novel written with William Fortune. And I may be mispronouncing that. We'll find out in a moment. And Land of the Pilgrim's Pride by Calista is a children's book. And I want to get into both of these in just a minute, but first, a little bit of political speak. Newt Gingrich, welcome back to the program, sir.
I'm glad to be back with you, and I appreciate you helping us launch this American Legacy book tour, which is what Clifton and I will be on for the next 6 weeks.
Well, as a fellow author, I am always pleased to give a good plug to a good book, and I've read pieces of Victory at Yorktown. It's very evocative. You get inside George Washington's head in a way that I think is actually probably pretty solid. And we'll get to that. The one thing that I and thank you for coming on the program. It's been several years since you've been on, but it's good to have you back. And the thing that I've been wanting to ask you for a long, long time, just as a predicate, first of all, back when Jefferson was John Adams' vice president, when the Alien Sedition Acts were signed in 1798, Jefferson, in protest, left town, refused to be in Washington, D.C. when that happened. And there was, this really, bad blood between the two of them. And then Jefferson and Madison went on to found the Democratic-Republican Party, the modern-day Democratic Party, and basically conspired against John Adams and ultimately beat him in the election of 1800. First of all, we're not disagreeing on my portrayal of that history, right?
No, I think you. I was just down, by the way, Ed. Chris and I had a wonderful opportunity to go to Poplar Forest near Lynchburg, which is Jefferson's summer home that he built. It's an octagon. It's a remarkable small treasure that I recommend anybody who's interested in that period. But now you captured pretty well the enmity between Adams and Jefferson.
Okay, so and the reason I wanted to set that up was because I want our listeners to know and our viewers to know that a political party or politicians conspiring against another political party or working to oust another politician who's already in office is nothing new. This was during the term of the second president of the United States. So which leads me to my question for you, which is about what I read in Robert Draper's book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives, where he writes that on the 20th of January, 2009, the night that Barack Obama was being inaugurated, I was here in D.C. At the Union Station inaugural ball, that you and Frank Luntz and Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker got together at the steakhouse, which literally is in the building that I used to live in over on 9th and F, the caucus room, and had a private four-hour meeting in which, according to Draper, later Hensling, I believe it was, or was it? No, it was Pete Sessions actually wrote for the National Journal that you guys decided that you were going to become the Taliban insurgency. He said, you have to understand, we will become the insurgency. I think insurgency is a mindset. The Taliban taught us this. We need to understand that insurgency is going to be required when dealing with the other side. And you were quoted in the book as saying that after this dinner, you'll remember this as the day the seeds of 2012 were sown. Is that all accurate?
Well, in part. I mean, first of all, Taliban, I think, is not a term I would have used because they're terrorists. But if you were to go back to the three volumes we've written in Washington, he certainly is an insurgent. The Founding Fathers were all insurgents. And as you point out, Jefferson is an insurgent against the Adams presidency.
Right.
So that part of it is a very long...
So were you guys insurgents against the Obama presidency?
Well, the fact is, look, the opposition party ought to sit down and try to figure out how to get back in power. Mm-hmm. That's why they're the opposition party.
Right.
If they're not going to try to get back in power, they might as well switch parties and join the incumbent party.
I don't disagree. Although I would submit that when Jefferson and Madison were organizing against Adams and putting together the Democratic Republican Party out of the anti-federalists, that the country was not losing 800,000 jobs a month, was not on the verge of a Great Depression, was not in the midst of probably one of the four or five great crises in its entire history. Things were actually quite stable
sure
at that
was.
Time.
There's a long period of difficult economic times. There's a naval war with France. There, Jefferson himself as president imposes an embargo against shipping with Great Britain.
Well, that was after 1800.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, these guys had a very tiny country with a very thin margin of survival, were deeply concerned that the British and the French would tear them apart and return them to 13 separate independent states that they could manipulate.
Right.
But they also took very seriously that they had a profound disagreement about the nature of the American experiment, and they pursued it very intensely on both sides.
Yeah.
By the way, there's a brand new movie out about Lincoln. Lincoln is involved in a very similar process, which ultimately ends up in civil war.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing that movie next weekend. All of these, every single man that I named voted yes to the Bush-Cheney bailing out of Bear Stearns, AIG, both TARPs, September and October, and then voted no on everything after that. No to anti-rape amendment from Al Franken, Lilly Ledbetter, Fair Pay Act, anti-outsourcing bill. Seems like anybody would like that. Was this... purely a political plan to basically kneecap the economy to hurt Obama?
No. I mean, look, there's a fundamental philosophical difference about how the economy works. When a president comes in, and I thought at the time and said at the time that based on his speech in Manassas the Saturday before the election, mm-hmm. his Grant Park speech election night, and his inaugural, I thought that President Obama had an opportunity in January of 2009 to genuinely govern in an Eisenhower style and force the Republicans to be his allies and probably split the Republican Party. He promptly turned to Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and drafted a stimulus bill that had $780 billion in spending with no elected official having read it. So, I mean, not only was there no Republican participation, there was no elected Democrat participation. Now, I think it's a bit much to say to the opposition party, you owe the president a blank check. Why don't you vote for this $780 billion you don't believe in that will increase the national debt and you don't think it'll improve the economy? And by the way, we could have a long argument on whether he actually slowed down the rate of decline or whether he cut off the rate of improvement. But
sure.
That's part of the philosophical difference about the nature of America. Do you want an America centralized in Washington? Or do you want an America that is largely decentralized in the states. And in
except
the
that all
sector.
These guys, and I don't want to extend this too much, and I promise the next segment we're doing nothing but your book, okay, and you and Calista. All of these guys had voted with Bush for these big government programs and these bailouts that Obama comes in, and all of a sudden they're anti-big government.
I suspect almost all of them regret having voted with Bush.
Yeah, okay. I suspect you're right. I suspect you're absolutely right. But, you know, a number of them, I mean, Paul Ryan.
By the way, you can make the same case for liberals. Liberals who were deeply opposed to assassination have said nothing about the use of predators because apparently as long as you only assassinate from 20,000 feet, it's okay.
Actually, a lot of liberals have spoken out against that, including this one. I believe that that,
been,
that,
no
that, that is a war crime.
Senate or House floor. There's been no systematic effort to do anything that would be politically effective.
Yeah, well, there should be. And on that, you and I, Newt Gingrich, agree. We're going to take about a four-minute break here. And when we come back, Newt Gingrich and his wife Calista is going to join us briefly. We're going to talk about his new book, Victory at Yorktown, and her book, Land of the Pilgrim's Pride. If that's all right with you?
That's great.
Okay, Speaker Gingrich will be with us in just a moment, or in about four. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back with former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich and author of Victory at Yorktown and his wife Calista, Land of the Pilgrim's Pride. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and we are speaking with former Speaker of the House and presidential candidate Newt Gingrich. And Speaker Gary, you're still here with us?
I sure am.
Great. Thank you. By the way, I want to invite you to come back on this program at some point in the future for a totally friendly interview about judicial review. I've written about this at some length, including a part of a book that I wrote. I think it's crazy, this whole concept, the Marbury versus Madison concept. I have played clips of you denouncing it and you quoting Hamilton from the Federalist Papers. And sometime let's do that, all right?
I'd love to do it. That'd
okay.
be great.
Great. Now, Victory at Yorktown, a novel. Newt Gingrich and William, is it Fortune? Am I pronouncing it right?
William Fortune.
Fortune, thank you. And Victory at Yorktown is about, tell us.
Well, it's about George Washington having the courage to first send a large part of his army to the south to fight the British while he held the main British army in New York City, and then having even more courage to take his forces and march down through Philadelphia. Remember, there are no helicopters, no airplanes. This is all marching by foot down to Yorktown, where he joins up with the rest of the American army and with our French allies. They trap Cornwallis, and he surrenders. I think, interestingly enough, the song they play during the surrender ceremony is "The World Turned Upside Down," and that's the key victory that ultimately leads to American independence. It was a campaign of great courage, great moral decisions on Washington's part, and a real rolling of the dice after a very long war with a country that was very tired.
Yeah, and you did a marvelous job of portraying it here in this book, Victory at Yorktown, a novel, by the way, I should say. Very readable. Speaker Gingrich, the 3 years before the Revolutionary War really began, there was more or less of a debate in the UK, and fact check me on this if I have any of this wrong, years, times, dates, whatever, where the question was raised, is it conceivable that the American colonists could raise an army, and particularly a military, you know, basically enough cannons or enough warships to take on the British Navy and the, you know, the British Imperial Force. And the conclusion was that it was impossible, and therefore we didn't have to worry about these rabble-rousers. First of all, is that consistent with your understanding of history?
Yeah, and it's consistent with their arrogance. They had put down peasants in Scotland, Wales, Ireland, and England. They were used to putting down peasant rebellions. And I think it's only on April 19th, 1775, at Lexington and Concord, when they encounter trained militia who are armed, and they are defeated decisively that day, that the British begin to realize this is something different. The Americans are actually creating a country, which is part of why when Calista wrote Land of the Pilgrim's Pride, it's about a period people don't look at. It's the colonial era, which identifies our future and really defines us as Americans before the Declaration.
If the tactics that Washington and many of the patriots, the American fighters, used were referred to by the British repeatedly as terrorist tactics. This was an insurgency. They shot from behind trees, whereas the British marched in formation. To what extent do you think that was the decisive factor in our defeating the British?
Well, not very much. One of the things Washington does, which we covered in an earlier novel called Valley Forge, is Washington brings in a Prussian officer, von Steuben, and trains the American army in fighting in a European manner, because Washington understands that until you have what was called the Continental Line, and until you can stand and slug it out with the British, you can wage a war of attrition, but you can't beat them. In order to defeat them, you have to have a full-blown army in the field, a professional army, and that's what he builds during the course of the war. So
right.
Washington himself had served with the British Army in the French and Indian Wars. He understood the nature of European warfare. He had studied it for his whole life. And he was a remarkable man at a moment when that's exactly what we needed.
Yeah, I absolutely agreed. Your wife, Calista Gingrich, has written this children's book, illustrated by Susan Archiro, Land of the Pilgrim's Pride. Is she there? You want to drop her on the phone? And
hi, Tom. This is Calista. Thanks for having us.
Hi, Calista. Thanks for joining us. This is a sweet book. You're going through state by state, basically, and telling in short form with nice pictures the stories of the states. I mean, I have it in front of me. Is that how you would describe it, or I'm guessing you have a more eloquent way of describing it?
That's pretty accurate. In Land of the Pilgrim's Pride, Ellis the Elephant, who is my main character, discovers how America began as he learns about our 13 original colonies. And if we want to keep our country great, our kids really have to understand where we've come from. And colonial America is a major and often unknown part of our history, spanning almost 170 years. And this period is a very important period because it's the time in which our characteristics and traits as Americans are shaped. So it's vital that our kids understand how we became American.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now, your husband used to represent me in Congress. I used to live up in Roswell, Georgia, and in Sandy Plains, Sandy Springs, excuse me, Marietta, Georgia, pardon me. Louise and I lived in Marietta for 5 years and 5 years in Roswell. And I turned to the page on Georgia, and you said those who needed a second chance came to the colony of Georgia without any shame. Was Georgia not a penal colony? Is this a kind of a euphemism for that?
Well, in Georgia, Ellis learns, and we all learn, about the fallen and underprivileged who were given a second chance by working their way out of debt rather than going to prison.
Okay. And the Wesley brothers, was this John Wesley who founded the Methodist Church?
That's right. We have the Wesley brothers in Georgia, and something, you know, they brought Methodism to our country, of course, and also they composed many of the hymns that we still sing today in many of our Christian churches.
Very, very interesting. What's your favorite of the stories of the states here in Land of the Pilgrim's Pride?
I have been blessed to work with Susan Archiro, who is our illustrator, that has brought each of the illustrations to life. But I have to say, I really like Ellis the Elephant as a pirate, as he roams along the North Carolina coast.
Ah, yes. And my recollection is you said North Carolina was a tough place to live.
That's absolutely right.
That's right. Okay. I see I read your book. Calista Gingrich and Land of the Pilgrim's Pride is the new children's book, and Victory at Yorktown, a novel, the new book by Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you. We will be back 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with more right after this. Stick around.
Tom Hartman.
He is the only man to ever ace a Rorschach test.
Welcome back. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Okay, Robert Draper in his book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do Inside the U.S. House of Representatives, writes that this was an invitation-only four-hour meeting at the Caucus Room restaurant where with Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich and these 14 members of the Republican members of the House of Representatives in the Senate, the senior GOP members, writes Keep Him Honest over at Daily Kos, the senior GOP members, paraphrasing Draper's book, plotted to bring Congress to a standstill regardless of how much it would hurt the American economy by pledging to obstruct and block President Obama on all legislation. Now, we have contacted many of these members of Congress. None of them will come on this program and discuss this. Frank Luntz is not interested in coming on this program and discussing this. And so, you know, I have been looking for, a year now for an opportunity to ask somebody, or half a year, to ask somebody who was actually there, did this really happen? This meeting really happen? Did these guys really get together and say, we're going to obstruct this president, we're going to fight him every step of the way? And Newt Gingrich just basically said, yeah. Welcome to the tough, rough and tumble world of politics. Nelson in East Moline, Illinois. Hey, Nelson, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I've heard a lot of talk about the CEOs complaining about health care costs, but I'd like to present my view of the whole thing. My weekly cost out of every check just for health care is $284.
Holy cow.
And that's for my wife and I. No.
Are you paying like about half of your total premium? Your employer's paying the other
right.
half?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Right. And now I'm 65. I'm really sort of stuck because I can't do anything because my wife is 3 years younger, and so
for another 3 years, she won't have access to health insurance unless you provide it.
Right. Yeah. So I'm stuck. $284 a week.
Yeah.
Absolutely no relief.
Yeah, that's a tough one. You're stuck for at least another year and a half, I guess. 2014 Obamacare kicks in. And
right.
and maybe then she would have some relief. But Nelson, thanks for calling and sharing the story with us. James in Belvedere, Illinois. Hey, James, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you.
Thank you for calling.
I got a position. It seems like all these subsidies and tax breaks for corporations and business seems to go against their free market ideology. I don't believe that's free market, but yet they always want to depress the wages for the worker and subject him to free market constraints. To me, they don't want to pay taxes at the top, yet they depress our wages to where our taxes are diminished too because of the lack of income that we pay. So basically, no taxes are being, all taxes are being depressed.
Yeah, the net effect of Reagan's dropping the top tax rate of the Reagan tax cuts and then the Bush tax cuts, which were a tiny fraction of that. I mean, Reagan took them from 74% down to 28%. They popped back up again over the next few years. And then Bush took them from 39.5% down to 36%. The net effect of those tax cuts was to actually decrease tax revenues through the obvious mechanism of tax cuts, but B, by saying to rich people, okay, the more you make, the more you'll be able to keep of what you make, and therefore the very wealthy and the CEOs and whatnot. Therefore, you see these obscene situations where people like Stephen J. Hemsley, the CEO of United Healthcare, particularly because a lot of it is stock, drawdowns, that he can pay capital gains tax on a maximum 15%, the Mitt Romney tax. These guys just take these obscene amounts of money. He took over $1 billion with a B out of United Healthcare, out of this, out of one of the nation's largest health insurance companies, as did his predecessor, Bill McGuire. And I mean, that's $2 billion for two CEOs. And they wouldn't have been able to do that, or they wouldn't have bothered to do that if the top tax rate was 74% like it was under Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, or if it was 91% like it was under FDR and Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower and Jack Kennedy. And it's an incredibly destructive thing, dropping taxes like this. Now, one of the other things that I think is really, and James, thanks for the call, for pointing this out. One of the other things really important to note is President Obama is saying, okay, this is how I think this is going to play out. I think that they're going to wait until the end of the year, because all these Republicans have done a blood oath to multimillionaire K Street lobbyist Grover Norquist, who, by the way, Can you believe this? Grover Norquist was asked on network television what he thought of Mitt Romney the other day. This is what he had to say.
The president was committed, elected on the basis that he was not Romney and that Romney was a poopy head, and you should vote against Romney.
Right. That's Grover Norquist. So anyhow, that guy, that multimillionaire K Street lobbyist, who when he doesn't like people, calls them poopy heads, that guy got all of these people, maybe Mitt Romney didn't sign the pledge, I don't know, but got virtually all the Republicans in the House and Senate to sign this pledge saying that they would bow down to Grover Norquist before they did to the people who put them in office, their constituents, and before they would honor the U.S. Constitution, which says that you can raise taxes. It's right there, Article 1, Section 8, Sentence 1. So because of that pledge to Norquist, the Republicans are not going to, in this calendar year, or this political year, which I guess ends in the 3rd or 4th of January, they're not going to be able to say, okay, let's raise taxes on the rich. But at the end of the year, the Bush tax cuts expire. They only lasted 10 years to begin with because they were pushed through by reconciliation, something the Republicans are really good at and the Democrats have to learn how to do. They were pushed through by reconciliation. And then Obama, in one of his compromises, one of his grand compromises, extended them for two more years in order to prevent the Republicans from slashing extended unemployment benefits even more than they did. They slashed them from 96 weeks down to 74 weeks, and but they wanted to take them to 50 weeks. And Obama said, you know, give those people an extra 24 weeks, and I'll extend your Bush tax cuts for 2 years. So, but here's how it works. If they just let them expire at the end of the year, the tax rate goes back up to what it was under Bill Clinton, when we had a balanced budget and a surplus. And then Obama can say, here's a piece of legislation I'm suggesting. Now, it's going to have to, the Republicans are going to have to actually write it because it has to originate in the House of Representatives. But here's a piece of legislation I'm recommending that anybody making under $250,000 or your first $250,000 of income, you know, the tax rate is going to be below, you know, it's going to be where it is now. It's going to be reduced. In other words, it's going to be tax cuts on that. And then if somebody earns over $250,000, of course, they get the tax cuts on the first $250,000. You know, Warren Buffett and Bill Gates will still get those tax cuts on their first $250,000. But then after that, it's 39%, 39.4, 39.5, 39.6, whatever it is. They pay that. And that way, the Republicans can say on January 5th or 10th or whatever, you know, whenever this might finally pass, after we've kind of driven over the fiscal cliff, but really it hasn't done anything because you can make this legislation retroactive. And if anybody's paycheck or check is late in coming, it won't be more than a week. Then the Republicans can say, and it's a horrible inconvenience, I understand, for many people, particularly long-term unemployed. That's the one group that will get hit by this that I'm concerned about. There was a carve out for the military in the sequestration. They don't get, you know, soldiers don't get hurt. Veterans don't get hurt. You know, pretty much most people aren't going to get hurt by this. But what this would do is it would allow the Republicans to say to Grover Norquist, we didn't raise taxes. They went up automatically at the end of the year. We had no control over it. And then we lowered taxes on the middle class. Now, that's not going to satisfy Grover Norquist because he's a multimillionaire and he represents multibillionaires as a lobbyist on K Street. But he can't say that they violated his pledge. So watch how this plays out. And the other thing that concerns me is that there have been signals, you know, the grand compromise that John Boehner and Barack Obama worked out last year that got blown up by Eric Cantor has been leaked. And in it, Obama had cut Social Security and Medicare. Slightly, but cut them. And it's the principle of the thing. And I'm with Bernie Sanders on this. We need to be, you and I need to be calling the White House comment line, and saying no. Go to callcongress.org, by the way, the phone number's there. And call the White House and say no. Do not cut or compromise in any way on Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. Do not. This is core social safety net stuff. And even with this stuff in place as it is right now, you've got 45,000 Americans dying every year because of lack of health insurance. I mean, this, you know, we need Obamacare to kick in. And start, you know, come on, grow up here. Let's start getting tough with these Republicans. They can meet over at the caucus room restaurant, and Newt Gingrich 2 years later can come on the air and say, oh, yeah, of course, this is what people do. Well, come on, take the fight to them.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And I'm curious your thoughts about Newt's argument and justification of these 14 congressmen and him getting together to sabotage the president. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Greg in Youngwood, Pennsylvania. Hey, Greg, what's on your mind today? Greg? Listening on Sirius XM in Youngwood, Pennsylvania? Crickets. Okay. Cora in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Cora, what's up?
Well, first of all, that cliff might be like the man from Snowy River, if you remember that movie. But I was just going to make
I never saw the movie. What are you talking about?
Well, it was an Australian story, and it was about the rich and the poor and the one young man who literally rode his horse down a cliff to gather up horses, and he was very successful. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I just want to make a quick point that corporations can receive welfare for years without end, but if you're an individual, you can only receive it 5 years total throughout your whole lifetime.
Excellent point. Thanks to Bill Clinton, by the way.
Right.
This is the reform of welfare that I think needs to be unreformed. It made a lot of sense when we were in the middle of a bubble, you know, in a really boom time. But in retrospect, it's really hurt a lot of people. And
Right. Welfare
needs to be unreformed or re-reformed or whatever you want to call it. But excellent point. And you're right. The corporations, I mean, arguably, John Rockefeller. It was in his lifetime that there were first holes drilled into the tax code to provide for what we now call the oil depletion allowance. That was in the late 19th century. So here we are, you know, 120 years later, and they're still drawing welfare checks. And you're absolutely correct. A human being, 5 years and you're out, Charlie. Cora, thank you for the call. Leck in Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Leck, what's on your mind? Leck? Oh, we got a lot of people who are asleep at the switch here. Peter in Voorheesville, New York. Hey, Peter, what's up?
Tom, thanks for taking my call, and I'm glad you're getting stronger because we're going to need you for the fight coming up.
Thank you.
My point is, and from insights of your program, is there have been no gainful investments in the last 32 years unless you're in the 1% and you have a tax break.
Or you're a military contractor, yes.
Yeah. As you say, the best investment is a lobbyist, therefore a tax break.
Right.
And you pointed out on your program, like the 1% in the last 32 years make 275%, the middle class made 20%, and the poor went down.
Right. And actually, if you define the middle class not as the second and third quintiles, but just as the third quintile, as the middle quintile, the middle fifth of Americans, or the middle and bottom and the second and the next to the bottom quintile, their incomes have gone down as well since the Reagan presidency.
Right. So therefore, I say like the economy is not working for us, Tom, for the 99%.
Yeah, well, it's certainly not working for the 96 or 95%.
Yeah,
it might be working okay for the bottom half of the top 5%. It's working very, very well for the top 2% of the nation. Yes, your point
exactly.
Or is that the point you wanted to make?
That was the point I wanted to make, Tom. Thank you.
You made it very well. Thank you, Peter. I appreciate it. Juan, listening on KABQ in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Juan, what's up?
Hello, Tom. No, we're not asleep at the switch. See, I've been on hold for 2 hours, so
yeah, that might have something to do with it.
Dropping off.
Thank you very much for holding. So, what's up?
No, basically, what I wanted to say is that what we need to have is a movement and not a moment. We had a moment with Obama after 2008,
mm-hmm.
and then we fell asleep at the switch.
That's an excellent
analysis.
And
they hammered us in 2010, and the thing is, you know, Obama needs to keep his organization intact and pass it on to the next candidate for the candidates for the midterms and the candidates for president.
I mean,
we can't stop organizing.
I absolutely agree with you, Juan. And Shano tells me that he has decided that you, if you're still on the line, you're still there, Juan?
Yeah, I'm here. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes. Shane has decided that you're the guy who's going to get an autographed copy of Cracking the Code, my book on the history of American democracy, the liberal movement, and conservative movement as well, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. So I'm going to put you on hold so Louise can pick up the call. It's line five, Shane, and the one is on, and we will get you a book here. Chuck in Norman, Oklahoma. Hey, Chuck, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to comment. You know, you're talking about the 12 guys who got together and
14.
Made sure that 14. Okay. Well, one of them, of course, was my senator, Tom Coburn.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I just, to me, that's treason. I think those guys should be maybe. I mean, somebody ought to look in. The Justice Department should maybe look into the idea that that was a treasonous act.
I don't think so.
You know,
I think it is morally a treasonous act to say we're going to take down the country for political gain. But it is not at all unusual in the annals of politics for politicians to behave this way. What it should tell us is that the men on this list whose names I read and would be pleased to read again, and we certainly will as time goes on, over and over and over again, that none of them should be returned to Congress, that all of them are moral traitors to America. But this is not giving aid and comfort to the enemy. This is simply, you know, destroying your country for political gain, economically destroying your country.
Well, I'm just so happy that, you know, the election this year was not stolen like it was in 2000.
Oh, but it was. I mean, they stole at least 5 or 6 million votes. You still have a 500,000 votes in Arizona that haven't been counted. There's millions of votes all around the nation that haven't been counted. These voter suppression efforts were very effective. The only reason why Democrats won as well as they did is because, you know, they're going to steal 5 million votes. We turned out 8 or 10 million extra votes.
I agree with you. I've worked on Kerry's campaign in Florida in 04, and it crushed me that he decided to go ahead and let Ohio go without a fight.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I'm very pleased that, you know, enough.
But here's where it's dangerous, Chuck. All those extra people showed up just like they did in 2008. But in 2010, they figured, okay, you know, we got Obama. We got this thing in the bag. Let's go to a football game or go to a party. Mm-hmm. And if we do that same thing in 2014, we're going to have a real serious problem. 2014 needs to be another big change election, and we need to take back the House of Representatives in 2014 and solidify the gains in the Senate and make this and push President Obama into being another FDR, into being a progressive president. You know, we need another progressive president, or at least another LBJ without the Vietnam War, thank you very much, but with the Great Society. And Chuck, thank you very much for the call. Good to hear from you. We'll be back. Chuck, let's see. Oh, yeah, Norm Stamper is going to be with us, member of the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, former chief of the Seattle Police Department. Stick around. This is going to be interesting.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Norm Stamper is on the line with us. He is a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP, LEAP.cc is the website. He is the former chief of the Seattle Police Department and an author. Chief Stamper, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. It's good to be back with you.
Thank you very much. An author. What is the title of your most recent book?
Breaking Rank, A Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing.
Thank you. I should have had that written down there and available in all the usual suspects, bookstores and whatnot, I'm guessing.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Norm Stamper, the states of Washington and Colorado have now said pot is legal in our state. We have become Amsterdam. Amsterdam allows, I told the story, 9/11, the airlines were offering super cheap flights, free, virtually free. I could use miles. So Louise and I and our three kids went to Amsterdam for the Christmas, you know, in the month after 9/11. and we got a $400 a night room at the Marriott for $112 a night. I mean, nobody was flying. Everybody was scared.
Sure.
We had this wonderful time. Went into the fanciest restaurant right across the street from the Rijksmuseum and from the big casino there in the fancy part of Amsterdam, white linen tablecloth. Sat down at the restaurant with all three of our kids are over 21. They're all adults. Sat down with our three kids, and the waiter comes over, you know, with the cloth over his arm and the menu, and he says, "Here, sir, is the wine menu," and he hands me a menu, and he says, "And here is the pot menu," and he hands me a menu. Now, it's technically illegal in Holland, but this was our experience in probably one of the five finest restaurants in Amsterdam back in 2001. And so is that the situation now that Washington and Colorado, I mean, how is this playing out, and how are the police departments responding to this, and what's LEAP doing about this? I'm just curious the whole thing. What's going on here?
Well, I think the, you know, Tuesday produced some very obvious winners and losers. And the losers are the drug cartels, the street gangs, and those really on both sides of the law who profit from mass incarceration, and the winners are the rest of us. Mm-hmm. Taxpayers, police officers, advocates for community safety and social justice.
And not necessarily potheads.
And not necessarily potheads at all. We're talking about a civil liberties issue. We're talking about a public health and safety issue. We know, for example, that marijuana is much safer than alcohol, and it's healthier than tobacco. And the fact that it was prohibited for all of those decades, I think, is a testament to our willingness to turn the other way when it comes to common sense and science.
Well, it's also a testimony to the power of the diesel industry and the paper and wood industry.
Yeah.
But anyway, pardon my interrupting.
In answer to your question, I think police officers across this state, and I'm assuming in Colorado as well, are much relieved. For many of them, making very low-level, nonviolent marijuana busts was a waste of time, and you couldn't afford to, you know, just turn your back on it, because that begins to suggest corruption or, right, you know, the kind of policing that relies on excessively on discretion.
Mm-hmm.
You can't leave it up to beat cops to make those decisions. This is a decision that the electorate had to make, and I'm just so glad that that ours did.
Yeah, yeah. And this is, my personal experience with this is somewhat limited, but I think it was 69 was the year, as I recall, which would have been the first year of the Nixon presidency. One of my very, very best friends from high school was arrested with a relatively small amount of pot, but it wasn't an insignificant amount, in Michigan. And this was the height of the drug hysteria, the drug laws, the war on drugs, all this kind of stuff. They threw the book at him to make an example. I mean, he drew 2 years in prison and served 2 years in the state prison. And when he came out, I didn't know him. I mean, he was broken.
Yeah.
And we are doing that routinely, particularly to people of color, but, you know, pretty much to anybody who gets caught up in the machine. Do you have any sense of how many lives have been destroyed by this, what is it, about a 70-year experiment with prohibition, 80-year experiment with prohibition?
Well, it certainly does go that far back, but as you mentioned, during the Nixon administration, when President Nixon proclaimed drugs public enemy number one and declared all-out war on them,
right,
we have spent $1 trillion. We have incarcerated tens of millions of Americans for nonviolent, very low-level drug offenses. And, you know, I just say to people, use your imagination. How many of those lives have been damaged, if not ruined, as a result of a criminal arrest?
Right.
And I think it's safe to conclude that the drug war has caused far more harm than good. I think it's the worst social policy since slavery and Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's high time we did what we did on Tuesday in those two states. It's for me, it's the beginning of the end of the drug war, and I'll tell you the truth, I never thought I'd say that in my time.
You know, I think so too. I think that much like the early cracks in segregation were Brown versus Board in 1954 and forced busing in the early 60s, but it really hit its, and even the Civil Rights Acts in the mid 60s, you know, we saw the full fruition of this with the nomination and successful election to the president of the United States of a man of color in Barack Obama. It took basically a generation or two generations. But once that tipping point was passed, there was no turning back. And I think looking back on it, that tipping point probably was between 54 and 60. And it feels to me like this is a similar tipping point right now. And the first political party that seriously gets behind this, whether it's the libertarian wing of the Republican Party or the pothead wing of the Democratic Party or just the rational wing of the Democratic Party, they're going to start winning elections like there's no tomorrow.
There is no question about that. Young people overwhelmingly supported the electorate's decisions in Colorado in Washington last Tuesday. And given that demographic and the fact that even among other age groups and across the country, we're now at 50% approval for legalizing marijuana. Mm. Go back to 1969. The figure at that time when Gallup first did its poll was 12% support.
Wow.
And all the rest opposed. And certainly that reversal has been a long time in coming, but it, as you point out, it is not reversible. What we will see is more and more support for sane and sensible drug laws. And you're right, if political parties will wise up to that fact, they're bound to reap the benefits for years to come.
Yeah, I absolutely think so. Is there any indication? We're talking with Norm Stamper. He's a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Leap.cc is their website. He is the former chief of the Seattle Police Department and the author of the title of your book again?
Breaking Rank.
And Chief Stamper, in the minute we have left, do you or any of the members of LEAP have any sense of what the Obama administration is going to do about this?
The short answer is no, we really don't. We have attempted to appeal to the Obama administration on a number of occasions, even marched on the drug czar's office here about a year ago.
This is cops marching.
Report. And we got the cold shoulder. And it's interesting because, of course, my successor in Seattle as police chief is Gil Kerlikowske, who's now our drug czar.
Mm.
I think for years the attitude has been don't talk to the other side, don't talk to the drug policy reformers.
Right.
And I think it's safe to say now they have to talk to us.
Well, and that again, is another indication that we've hit a tipping point. Former chief of the Seattle Police Department, Norm Stamper, author of Breaking Rank, member of the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, leap.cc. His Twitter is Cops Say Legalize. Chief Stamper, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. My pleasure.
Great. Pleasure and an honor speaking with you, sir. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, is this coming to your state next? And what about the Portugal experiment? They decriminalized everything.
Folks thought they would go far, but political incompatibility led to their downfall. Well, the one on the right was on the left, and the one in the middle was on the right, and the one on the left was in the middle, and the guy in the rear was a Methodist.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Thank you, Shane. Johnny Cash, one of my favorites. You know, the biggest message out of the 2012 election that you'll never hear from the corporate media in America is this, that Americans believe and voted to affirm that belief, the government can be a solution to the problems we face, the government can do good things, and that Ronald Reagan was wrong. America is not a right-wing nation. We're not even a center-right nation. We never have been. In 1935, FDR brought us Social Security. We loved it then. We still love it now. And that, of course, is just the tip of the iceberg of policies that prove America is a leftist nation. If you call leftists people who believe the government can do things well. It started with the founders who put the phrase general welfare in the Constitution twice. First in the preamble to define the reason our government was created. And then in the powers given to Congress, Article 1, Section 8, to raise taxes and spend money to promote the general welfare. People go, well, that's not one of the enumerated powers. Well, here's what one of our actual founders, Alexander Hamilton, had to say about the general welfare clause that he helped write into the Constitution. He was there at the Constitutional Convention. although he did leave for a couple of weeks, go back to New York in a fit of pique, because on opening day he had argued that the president should be appointed for life because we wanted to imitate the British monarchy, and they hooted him out of the room. But in any case, he came back, and he said, this was in the 21st part of his report to Congress. I misattributed it last week to the Federalist Papers. It's Hamilton's report to Congress on how to build a strong manufacturing sector, also known as his report on manufacturers, written in 1791 when he was the Secretary of the Treasury in the George Washington administration. He said, and I quote, "The terms general welfare were doubtless intended to signify more than was expressed or imported in those which preceded. The phrase is as comprehensive as any that could have been used because it is not fit that the constitutional authority of the Union to appropriate its revenues should have been restricted within narrower limits than the general welfare. It is therefore of necessity left to the discretion of the national legislature to pronounce upon which objects which concern the general welfare and for which, under that description, an appropriation of money is requisite and proper." End of quote from Alexander Hamilton. Since then, general welfare has included everything from Thomas Jefferson creating a free college system with the University of Virginia to Abraham Lincoln massively expanding that free college system with land-grant colleges across the nation and creating the Department of Agriculture, to Teddy Roosevelt passing the Pure Food Act, the Meat Inspection Act, creating the Department of Commerce and Labor, breaking up big corporations, regulating the railroads, to Dwight Eisenhower building the interstate highway system and massively expanding our schools and hospitals with government funds. You know, during the Eisenhower administration, 80% of the cost of every hospital built in this country was paid for with federal dollars. General welfare has included everything from child labor laws to the 40-hour work week to workplace safety laws. America has always advocated this liberal view as Americans. The first president to sign an appropriation to care for poor, homeless, and hungry people so they could get free housing, medical care, and food when they were down and out or disabled. The first president, George Washington. Our Revolutionary War in 1776 was fought on the premise that government could be good and that we could successfully prove that by creating a good government here in North America. Of course, there have been periods of time when, even though the vast majority of Americans have always been progressive, our government was more conservative. The reason for that disconnect? It's pretty simple. The majority of Americans couldn't even vote until 1920 when women got the vote. And even then, a large minority of Americans were kept away from the ballot box by Jim Crow policies that were only outlawed in the 1960s but continue to this day. In fact, we saw them 6 days ago in places like Ohio and Florida. You have to stand in line for 6, 8, 10 hours to vote. That's Jim Crow. But America has been a liberal nation since our founding. George Washington wrote a letter to Alexander Hamilton in 1796. And he said, if the nation could successfully educate all of our people, quote, sentiments of more liberality in the general policy of the country would result from it, end quote. In other words, George Washington said, give people a good education, they'll become liberals. The result over time was that we ended up with a national policy of free education for all of us. George Washington took us liberal, and we've been moving that way ever since. And so with this massive progressive victory in 2012, when more Democrats than Republicans even got votes for the House of Representatives, the Democratic Party finds itself at a crossroads. Are they going to return to the liberal roots of Thomas Jefferson, the founder of the party, and its standard bearers like FDR and JFK? Or is the Obama administration going to take the third way of discredited conservadems like Ben Nelson, Blanche Lincoln, and Erskine Bowles? At the end of his second term in office, FDR faced this exact same problem within his party. He wanted to go even more progressive, bringing in Democratic Socialist Henry Wallace as his vice president. The party was rebelling, saying they wanted a moderate. So FDR wrote a letter to the party saying, in the century in which we live, the Democratic Party has received the support of the electorate only when the party with absolute clarity has been the champion of progressive and liberal policies and principles of government. The Democratic Party has failed consistently when, through political trading and chicanery, it has fallen into the control of those interests, personal and financial, which think in terms of dollars instead of in terms of human values. It is best not to straddle ideals. The party must go wholly one way or wholly the other. It cannot face in both directions at the same time. End of quote. The Democratic Party went along with FDR, nominated Wallace, and kept moving in such a progressive direction that FDR even proposed a second Bill of Rights, although he died before he could see it through. So President Obama, Harry Reid, and Nancy Pelosi, question. Is your party the party of Jefferson, Roosevelt, and Kennedy? Or is it the party of Joe Lieberman, Erskine, Bowles, and Joe Manchin? Is it progressive or blue dog? Because the American people are solidly behind progressive policies. And now is the time the President Obama and the Democratic Party leadership have to decide. Are you with the people or are you with the banksters?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The next week is going to give us a real... Well, this week is going to give us a real interesting indication of that, although I suspect it's going to be played out over a few months. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Jim in Blackwood, New Jersey. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Talking earlier about the owner of the Applebee's who wants to lay off people with Obamacare taking effect. Well, Applebee's has restaurants in Massachusetts. Those employees are covered by RomneyCare. They have stores in Canada because, remember, up there they spelled neighborhood for you when they ate there. They have national health care up there.
Right. So Applebee's has not been put out of business by RomneyCare in Massachusetts or by National Health Care.
They also merged with IHOP, too. They're owned by the same company now.
I beg your pardon?
IHOP merged with Applebee's several years ago.
Oh, the International House of Pancakes, or what used to be called that. It's now IHOP. That's the same chain, or the same...
But they haven't closed any stores up there, as far as I know.
Yeah, and so they're functioning in Massachusetts and Canada as well. So, Mr. Hysterics... What was his name again?
It's Zane Tinkle, I think.
Tinkle, that's right. Tankle. Whatever. He's a little hysterical and a little unnecessarily. Well, excellent point, Jim. Thank you very much for calling and making it. Donald, I don't have a city for you, but you're listening to WCPT in the Chicago area?
That's true. Okay. I have a question, Pam. You know, this business with the CBO, I wonder if this going off the cliff, are they using that word that is a scare tactic?
Of course.
What gets me about, with the CBO, what really gets me and gets me really angry is the fact that, oh, now they're saying that, oh, yeah, it's going to cause a problem and it causes us to fall into a recession. Just a few weeks ago when they were evaluating Romney's plan, they were saying that it's not going to reduce the deficit and it's going to cause more problems let me take that back. They did say that we do need to raise the taxes. If I recall, the CBO said that, and Romney's plan would not work, and it would cause the deficit to increase. Am I correct in saying that?
As far as I know, yeah. And here's the thing you need to know about the Congressional Budget Office. They don't offer opinions unless asked for them, and they only answer the question that was asked. So... if you ask the question, what happens, by the way, Shane tells me that Ben Bernanke has, according to CNN Money, is the guy that invented the phrase fiscal cliff. It's not in the legislation or anything like that, but it's very evocative. You know, because cliffs are things you fall over. Shane was pointing this out to me last week. Cliffs are things that you fall over and you don't recover from. And this is more like a fiscal cliff with a bungee cord, because Congress can come back a week later and say, okay, you know, we're going to undo all this. And in fact, that's my prediction as to what they will do and how they will do it. Although we'll see. I mean, maybe the Republicans are even more chastened than I thought. But if you ask the CBO, what happens if sequestration is allowed to play out? We go over the fiscal cliff, all the tax rates go up, all the spending cuts go into place, spending goes down. What happens over the next 10 years, assuming nothing changes? Then, of course, they're going to say you're going to go into a recession. You're shrinking your economy. You're producing a balance, you know, closer to a balanced budget, but balanced budgets, you know, should be grown into the way Eisenhower did it, not cut into. Nobody has ever successfully cut their way into prosperity. It doesn't happen. And as we're seeing right now in Greece and Spain. So similarly with Romney's proposals, one of the problems the CBO had with scoring Romney's tax plan is that there were no details. And so they never said that Romney would produce a recession. They, to the best of my knowledge, they said that we can't, you know, offer an opinion on this because it's vague and incoherent.
One other question too, and I don't know if you can answer this. When they took out our AAA rating, the Standard & Poor's, could the Republicans have been behind that? Because Standard & Poor's is nothing but McGraw-Hill, if I recall. It's just another corporation.
Yeah.
Could they have also caused this crash with their buddies over there on Wall Street that just took place after Obama was elected? I sometimes wonder if they're responsible for all this. Am I wrong in thinking this?
Last year, during the debt ceiling negotiations, this is from Robert Draper's book that I quoted to Newt Gingrich earlier that he said was accurate, or it's from Keep Him Honest, writing over at the Daily Kos. I'm not sure which parts are Keep Him Honest's writing and which parts are quotes from Draper's book. But here's what it says. Last year, during the debt ceiling negotiations, Eric Cantor and Senator John Kyle, now these were two of the 14 conspirators in the caucus room conspiracy, the night that Obama was sworn into office. Last year during the debt ceiling negotiations, Eric Cantor and Senator John Kyle abruptly walked out of the negotiations and refused to renew discussions with Democrats. As a result, America's credit rating was lowered, which put a smile on Republicans' faces. So there you have it. Yeah, it was the Republicans who did it. And might they do it again? I don't know. I think that they're starting to experience blowback. And I think that they're looking at this election as blowback. And they're seeing that maybe Newt Gingrich and Frank Luntz and those 14 members of Congress who sat in that room weren't quite as smart as they thought they were. And, Mitch the Turtle, McConnell, is going to have to do something other than... You know, he can no longer say his only goal in life, as the leader of the Republicans in the Senate is to make Obama one-term president. He's already a two-term president. So what are you going to do now, Mitch? How about doing something in the interest of the country? Donald, thank you. Excellent, excellent call and excellent point. Tom in Holyoke, Colorado. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. Well, I was wondering if corporations are people, then do they need to pay into Social Security?
No. Well, actually, they do. They match your, an employer matches your contribution.
They don't qualify
for Social Security benefits.
Social Security.
No, they don't qualify for benefits. And this is another, just like Jonathan Freeman goes out and gets busted in the HOV lane because he's got a corporation in the car with him, and he says that's two persons. There's so many of these areas that I think need to be litigated. They're never going to go anywhere in the courts, but they make great PR stunts and point out to people the absurdity of this. Excellent point, Tom. Thank you. Jesse in Plainfield, Illinois. Hey, Jesse, what's on your mind?
Well, I was calling to find out. Facebook is kind of blowing up, and I'm seeing it all over Twitter and that about 20 of the states trying to secede from the union.
Well, there's lawmakers in Texas who are actually talking about it out loud and in the media right now.
Because they had named, there was actually, I think, 20 other ones, and that was the one from Texas. They're still waiting to get 25,000 on the 25,000 signatures so they get a response.
Right.
Does this happen all the time? Is this
no.
because we have a black president?
Yes.
What is the... Okay.
The last time this happened was 1860. 1861, whatever the year was that the Civil War started. And, we litigated that. Lincoln apparently thought it was going to be a short war. It turned out it wasn't. It was a horrible and horrific and bloody war. And I would say slavery was at the core of it. And I would say that slavery is still at the core of it. It's just a variation on slavery. It's called cheap labor, which is what slavery was. Slavery was not free labor. You had to feed slaves. You had to house slaves. You had to provide medical services for slaves. So it was cheap labor. And cheap labor is what the South is all about. They've all gone Taft-Hartley. They've all gone right to work for less. And now you've got foreign corporations like, Volkswagen and Foxconn coming in and saying, we'll build factories in these cheap labor countries, parts of the United States, so that we can sell goods into those parts of the United States like New York State and California that are not cheap labor, that are not right to work for less. And frankly, I think this time around, if the old Confederacy wants to say sayonara, we'll see you later, they want to withdraw from the United States, let them go. It's not worth fighting a civil war over. And I realize that many of our listeners and viewers are in that South, and I'm just not quite sure what to do about that other than saying, you know, fight the good fight. But if the crazies really do prevail, it is not worth a civil war over, frankly. Jesse, thanks for the call. Carol in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Oh, hey, Tim. I wanted to talk about the Social Security, but I want to agree with you. Yeah, let them secede because they take more out of the federal government than they pay into it, so
That's right.
All be better off.
That's absolutely right. They, you know, for every dollar that goes into the federal treasury in taxes from California, New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, you know, from the blue states, the maker states, they get back 60, 70, 80, 90 cents. For every dollar that goes into the federal coffers from the taker states, the red states, the Mississippis and Oklahomas and Louisianas of the world, you know, $1.10, $1.20, $1.30 comes back. They're all on the dole. They're all on welfare. And if they want to leave, okay.
Yeah,
anyhow, back to you.
But anyway, to get back to the Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, the history of that and the Greenspan, you know, what's overlooked is the Greenspan Commission that Reagan appointed,
right,
which meant that the boomers were going to pay for their retirement in advance,
right,
and they doubled the Social Security tax at that time.
Right.
And they knew, I mean, if you ever read the Greenspan Commission report, they knew that it was going to run out. There were going to have to be future adjustments,
yep,
but they said it's good for 75 years, and you'll have time to make those adjustments. And what has happened is Washington has ignored making the necessary adjustments.
I agree.
Since that was implemented. So I'm calling it the grand heist or the theft of the boomers' pre-funded retirement. I'm referring
it
as theft or the great American heist.
You know, somehow conservatives have managed to convince every 20 and 30-something that I know that the boomer generation, my generation, is somehow, you know, on the dole and ripping off the country. We're the generation that actually double-paid Social Security. We not only paid for the retirement of our parents, but we prepaid, as you correctly point out, Carol, our own retirement. And the plan was that when the last boomers die off 20, 30 years from now, that Social Security would actually, the fees would drop. It would go back to where it was. Carol, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Well, don't ask Paul Ryan about that, which leads me to wonder, what's going to happen to Paul Ryan? Is he really going to become the Ayn Rand face of the Republican Party?
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Maybe. Jeff in Canton, Michigan. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today? You want to talk about secession?
Yeah, the secession issue, just real quick. But I just want to address that thing about taxation on marijuana,
right,
real briefly. And I think you said it without saying it. It's the only way to convert a vice into a virtue.
Yeah.
Most people think it's a vice. And then when you tax it and make it a benefit to society, you turn it into a virtue.
Right, and they've done that with gambling in the form of lotteries. They've done it with nicotine in the form of cigarette taxes, alcohol taxes. Yeah, I agree. It's the only way to make it politically palatable, basically.
Right, and so the thing about secession, which I have never understood, is that the way I read the Constitution is that there's a supremacy clause regarding the states and the territory, which is the federal's power. It's the federal discretion. It's not given to the states.
Right.
In the Constitution, nowhere that I can find does it say that the states have the right to determine their own statehood or their own relationship to the Union. They are sovereign within their borders, commerce clause, and these kind of things. But this idea that the states can vote themselves out of the Union is an absurd idea, especially after the Civil War, because that's when incorporation starts and dual sovereignty is all but erased.
Mm-hmm.
The supremacy status of the federal government is clear in the amendments that follow the Civil War. I don't know where a state would find it in its authority, its sovereignty, or its ability to withdraw from the Union.
Yeah, I just read Article 4, Section 3, which is what you're referring to, and Section 4, for that matter, of Article 4, the relation of the states to each other. And there's not a specific, you may not withdraw from this Union. Although it does say Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations regarding the territory or other property belonging to the United States.
So So Congress would have to vote their exit. The state can't vote its own.
Well, I'm not sure, frankly. And it's going to be interesting to see. I was going to see that Lincoln movie this last weekend. I thought it was playing. Turns out it wasn't, so we went to see James Bond instead. But it's played next week. I am not a Civil War scholar, and I just don't know. But
well, in the original secession of South Carolina, when South Carolina does it first and other states follow,
right?
You know, a couple of amazing things is that in a number of the states that secede, the populations were against secession, but
right.
The legislatures of the state voted for it anyways, and the federal union, the federal government, said go. And the controversy came in turning over the forts and the supplies and the territories, and that's where we get the whole Fort Sumter thing, is that the supply ships are, you know, Lincoln draws the line on it, and that's when the problem.
It was it's sort of like everybody agrees on the divorce, but when it comes to splitting up the property, then the war starts.
Right, exactly, and again, back to the Constitution. There may be some scholar may be able to call in that knows it better than I and be able to describe to me how that wording says that the states have supremacy over their own union, over their place in the union after the Civil War. I just don't see it.
Right. Well, okay. I need to educate myself more about this, frankly, Jeff, before I go off on a rant about it. And to say, you know, just let him go is it's a cheap line. We need to have a more thoughtful conversation about it. And we will do that over the next week or two, particularly as more and more of this talk from these, I'm frankly, you know, thinking mostly, you know, racist folks, you know, largely down in the South. They're like, you know, I'm not going to be part of a country with Barack Obama, Hussein Obama is the president. Are you kidding? Matthew in Woodbridge, Illinois. You want to talk about Citizens United?
Yeah, I had some questions regarding it. Like, I don't understand how a company could be a person, or if I'm even quoting this right or not, but, like, how is money speech, and how is that even possible?
Okay, here's the history of it. For 400, 500, 600 years, according to Blackstone's legal books back in the 1700s, there were two types of persons. You had to be a person in order to pay taxes, in order to own land, in order to be able to enter into a contract. So obviously human beings could do all those things. But if you wanted a church to be paying taxes, or if you wanted a company, a corporation to be owning land and paying taxes or be able to be sued, it had to have some sort of status, some sort of standing in a court of law. And so to have that standing, it had to have personhood. So historically, we had two kinds of persons, natural persons and artificial persons. These are the words that were used by lawyers and legislators for 400 or 500 years. And in the Santa Clara County case in 1886, Sanderson, the lawyer for the railroads, came in and argued against Alvin Delmas, the lawyer for Santa Clara County, that before the Supreme Court, that the 14th Amendment says no person shall be denied equal access under the law. It doesn't say no natural person. And because it doesn't say no natural person, it includes corporations in the scope of the 14th Amendment. And if you read my book, Unequal Protection, I actually have long transcripts from those arguments before the Supreme Court in 1886. And then, of course, Delfin Delmas, the lawyer for Santa Clara County, said, you know, what are you saying, that corporations should be able to get married, that, you know, that they should, you know, and, you know, that they need to have the right to eat? You know, he goes on through this list of absurdities. And the court never actually ruled that corporations are persons. It's just that John Chandler Bancroft Davis, the clerk of the court, wrote it into the headnote, which had no legal authority. And boom, it became part of the lore of the U.S. Supreme Court. So that's how that happened. With regard to money being speech, that's a doctrine that by and large goes back to Lewis Powell, who was put on the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon in 73, who in Marbury versus Madison, excuse me, in Buckley versus Vallejo, said that because money can facilitate speech, you can buy an ad in a newspaper, or you can own a newspaper or radio station, it therefore has some status as speech. And it was a wrongly decided Supreme Court decision, and it was amplified in Citizens United. Both of these doctrines, which were invented out of whole cloth, never ratified by any legislature, came out of our crazy Supreme Court. tomorrow. Family Research Council. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.